The condition of an author is much like that of a strumpet. And if the reason be required, why, we betake ourselves to so scandalous a profession as whoring or pamphleteering, the same exclusive answer will serve us both, viz., that the unhappy circumstances of a narrow fortune hath forced us to do that for our own subsistence, which we are much ashamed of. Borakthung athletes, don't worry, we're not a theatrical podcast. Now, those were actually the words of Ned Ward from 1698, describing the nature of the pamphleteers of Grub Street, who are the subject of the latest series of Defoe by Pat Mills and Colin McNeil. We're going to be talking to Pat later about the new series, Change in Artist, the people he's lampooning with this latest series, and a little bit of the history and politics behind the 17th century zombie hunter known as Titus Defoe. Different kind of law enforcement after that. We're going to be talking to Alec Worley, who is the writer behind Anderson The Deep End, which is the latest US format one-shot comic, which will be coming out at the end of May. That collects his story from the Joyce Dread magazine from a little while ago. There's also going to be a collected edition along with Arthur Wyatt's Dust, which will be hitting stores in July. Thanks to everybody who has given us great feedback on the podcast. Apologies the other week for the technical issues with Podomatic that meant that we had a strangely truncated episode. You got some very, very, very edited highlights. So sorry if you had technical difficulties with that, but the episode should now be fine and ready to download. And make sure you're picking up 2080 at the moment, because last week's Prog 2024 began a new story called Harvey by John Wagner, John McCrae, Mike Spicer and Annie Parkhouse, which reintroduces the Mechanismo robot to Judge Dredd's universe. And he's not particularly happy about it, but some absolutely stirring work there from the two Johns, Mike and Annie. But with this issue, we continue the perfect jumping on point for new readers. So if you're not reading 2080, can heartily recommend it. It's a fantastic collection of ongoing stories. And Defoe is going to be one of them. So we talked to the master, Pat Mills, about going back to the 17th century and, what the politics are behind killing zombies in Renaissance London. So, Pat, let's talk about the new series of Defoe. We'll come on to what the series is about in a second, but I wanted to address the fact that we have a new artist on the series, don't we?
Yeah, absolutely. Colin McNeil, who, of course, is a classic 2080 artist and creates a very strong noir quality to 17th century London.
What was the reason for the change? Because Lee Gallagher has been with the series since the very beginning, and for me, was just kind of the quintessential artist for a series set in this time period. What was the reason for him moving on?
Well, I think Lee wanted a change. In other words, to try other things as well. And my God, was Lee a hard act to follow, because we tried out a number of artists after Lee, and they didn't tick all the boxes for Matt, and I think I'd pretty much given up. And then Matt suggested Colin McNeil, and of course I know what his work is like, and I thought he'd be perfect for it.
Because it's in monochrome. It's in the wonderful style that he developed on Insurrection with Dan Abnett. That kind of fully painted but still monochrome black and white artwork.
It gives it a lot of depth, that style, doesn't it?
No, absolutely. I mean, you mentioned noir, and that's kind of the perfect summing up of it. That everything's wreathed in shadows, but there's a real depth to it.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And And of course, it's pretty horrible as well. I mean, you've got sort of zombies roaming the dark alleyways of London. Yeah.
for somebody who's never read Defoe before, because it's been a little while since the last series, can you sum it up for them?
Defoe, it's set in what you might call an alternative 17th century Britain, 17th century London. It's a kind of clockpunk world, which is really just an earlier version of steampunk. And zombies have been unleashed in the Great Plague of 1666, 666. And there are demonic forces at work that are responsible for them. And Defoe is, with his various skills, both as a zombie hunter and also as a detective, to find out the sorcerers responsible.
Now, everybody knows you from Slain, essentially. You know, this is the strip for 2000 AD where you really married research and storytelling and created something new out of it. Of course, Defoe, you've taken actual history from the 17th century and spun something new out of it. Tell us a little bit about how you put that research together and how you decide to pick through and which bits that you take up.
Yeah, I mean, I think the whole principles of clockpunk and steampunk are pretty well established. So what you do really is you find key interesting areas and dramas, and then you research them and bring it to life. So, for example, in the latest one, the one that Colin's currently drawing, it's set in Grub Street. Now, Grub Street was the kind of Fleet Street of its day. So you've got all these kind of strange publications coming out, and in particular, chapbooks. Now, chapbooks were the comic books of their day. They predated the penny dreadfuls, and they're quite lurid and quite funny and ridiculous stories. So that's the background, and someone has done a chapbook, if you like, a comic book, about zombies, and that's the title of the book is Die Hards. These zombies who can't seem to be killed and have tremendous courage and fanaticism and just keep on coming back. You know, you're marrying together their zombies and something that's actually historically accurate, Grub Street, and the chapbooks, which are also historically accurate. And that's something that I think Colin in particular is very strong on. He's done some wonderful reconstructions of the covers of these chapbooks. And, you know, as they are a distant, what would you say, great-great-great-grandfather of 2000 AD, I think it has quite a lot of interest for readers on that level as well. And we get to meet, let me see, 1, 2, 3, I think 4 different publishers of chapbooks as well. So, you know, there's a distant echo there of, of today. And I think that makes it a lot of fun as well. So we're both enjoying it. And I should also add on the authenticity that Colin is really quite tough on that. He really wants, and you'll appreciate this as a reenactor, he really wants guns that work. So he was looking at the volley pistol, for instance, and he was saying, no, I really think, you know, it should be something that really can have automatic fire. And so I sent him some images of various clockpunk guns, which of course are entirely fanciful. I mean, they're pure fantasy. And he said, no, they wouldn't work. So he's actually designed a 17th century automatic musket that he tells me will work. And you'll have to have a look at it, Mike. And it's in the very latest episode. So, you know, you'll have to cast your professional eye over it and say, it's an enormous looking thing. And that's all that mattered to me as a writer. I said, as long as it's a big gun, that's what the readers are looking for.
Well, that's one of the things I've enjoyed so much about the previous series of Defoe is that, you know, you've used actual designs by Leonardo da Vinci and you know, the great scientists of the beginning of the Enlightenment to you know, and thrown them in, and they look ludicrous and extreme and you know, how could this possibly have worked? Because these were actual scientific suggestions. These were proper scientists and engineers who were suggesting these things.
Yeah, and the one that springs to mind, because one reader commented on in particular and obviously thought it was a bit stupid, was there was, you may know of this, I think it's originally an 18th century machine gun which fired bullets, automatic bullets, but they were like round musket balls for Christians and square musket balls for Turks. So I adapted that to round musket balls for humans and square musket balls for zombies. And I think one reader wrote in and said, I don't get it. Why would they do that? And I was thinking, and I wonder why they did it in the first place. But they did. I mean, that's the whole thing. These anachronisms of this earlier time than ours, where things weren't always completely sensible, shall we say.
One thing that you mentioned before was about how chat books were one of the great ancestors of comic books, and during the later 17th century you sometimes had the state trying to put the genie back in the bottle of press freedom, because during the English Civil Wars there's been this massive explosion in press freedom. And I wondered, given the recent publication of your book Read 'Em and Weep, which is about the heyday of British comics in the 70s and 80s, I wonder if Die Hard to a certain extent was a bit of a revenge for the taming of action back in the 70s.
I think in a funny sort of way it was, because when I was writing Die Hard and I was really focusing on the different publishers, there were lines that I would have used in Read 'Em and Weep, Book One, Serial Killer, you know, where and actually I thought, no, I can't use that now in Serial Killer, because I've used it in Die Hard. So to give you an example of that, there was, and fortunately, both Colin McNeil and myself, we both know this guy, and this is a very affectionate tribute to an editor who's since passed on at PC Thompson's, Gordon Small, and he was editor of Jackie. And when I was interviewed for a job at DC Thompson's, I can't do the Scottish accent properly, but I'll give it my best shot. He said, I'm not sure if you're couthy enough for us, laddie. So in Die Hard, there's a wannabe writer, and he's going, and he gets interviewed by a publisher who's publishing a chapbook called Golden Garlands for the Amusement of Young Maids, which is clearly the Jackie of its day. And he's saying to this guy, I'm not sure if you're couthy enough for us. And he's going, I can be couthy. just give me a job, sir. So, there are quite a number of parallels between the two. And the great thing with this one is, I mean, it's a memory of Gordon Small I have with great affection. And Colin remembers Gordon as well. So I think we're going to get a nice portrayal of Gordon there. And I hinted to Colin on the others. I said, does this ring any bells with you? And so my other possible role models for editors or publishers, he he doesn't really know them. So I think he's going to give them his own spin. So I think people in Scotland might recognise one or two other characters when they appear.
I mean, you mentioned the existence of Grub Street, which is the predecessor of Fleet Street. And the chat books were completely unregulated and completely over the top and completely ridiculous. And incredibly popular as a result. I mean, it's kind of clear that you are drawing on your own experience of comics in the 70s when there was still that industry. You know, you still had the two big publishing houses of DC Thompson and IPC who were pumping out thrills and chills and banal tales of derring do for kids who completely lapped them up.
Yeah, with those chilling lines, which I think have been the subject of a blog, Great News Inside This Week, which usually meant when the comic was gonna get axed. Yeah. I think the real tragedy of it is they didn't respect the readers in a way that we all do today, because we have to and we want to, but back then they didn't. And we all know this, they could be so arbitrary in the way they would slam two publications together, which were often rivals to one another, and the readership, if you like, belonged to entirely different gangs. Mm. So suddenly Tornado readers are in there with 2000 AD and... you know, these things are tricky to marry them up.
There's been quite a few people who've mentioned, indeed, at the 40th anniversary event just the other month, said, I started reading Star-Lord, but then when it merged with 2000 AD, I wasn't reading that rubbish. And it was years until I came back to it, because Star-Lord was better quality paper and more colour. I think one or two of the readers kind of looked down on 2000 AD as a bit of a scrappy underling.
Yeah, it always happens every time, and it's right to do so. And I mean, I think that particular marriage was okay. You know, 2000 AD and Star-Lord. Obviously, there will be some objections, but I mean, some of them were really rough. The mergers, and so I'm covering all this in Serial Killer. I mean, currently. The a fictional war comic, was it Blitzkrieg, has been axed before it even hit the newsstand. And now the creative team are currently working on Arg, which features a great white shark, amongst other things. So, I think we all know what's going to happen to that particular comic. But of course, the spin on it is different in the sense that it's not what should we call it? It's not a writing a fictional history of the past. It's a kind of an alternative. What if this character got control rather than another character? And most important of all, something that they really tried but we failed. If more women were in control, things would have run differently. And there was a strong possibility of that at one time. I mean, one of the 2008 editorial staff was Deirdre Vine, who went on to a very successful career elsewhere in publishing. Mm. So it's kind of like what would have happened if it gone slightly differently. Because, I mean, we all know this. I mean, any decisions anyone makes today on 2000 AD, there are variants. And things could go much better or not so well and so forth. So it's interesting to pursue that, I think. Mm.
Let's talk about politics, because it is something that runs through your work like lettuce through a stick of rock. there is politics in Slain, there's politics in Savage, and I think Defoe is... very much in the kind of invasion/savage mould, in that Defoe is a working class hero. You know, he's an ordinary man who finds himself having to compromise his own beliefs in order to get work. Was that a starting point for the strip originally, or was this something that he evolved into?
No, he'd always had that, but I needed that in the background to sort of explain, well, why would he do this horrible job? Mm. And for the most part, I mean, so many people, I mean, we've all had to do horrible jobs in the past, and we think, oh God, I don't know if I can face this anymore, you know, whether it's working in a bank or, you know, working in a, you know, a fish finger factory or something. And it's like that for Defoe, but his background, and once again, as a reenactor, I mean, I'd be fascinated to get your feelings about this. He's a leveler. Mm. And so he was at Naseby. He was an Ironside. And the levelers in particular, I'm really fanatical about, because I think primarily, and this probably goes for a lot of us, I didn't know about them at school. I knew about the Civil War between Cromwell and the Royalists and so forth, but I didn't know who the levelers were. Mm. And then, of course, probably like everybody else, I was taught all about the French Revolution and the Bolshevik Revolution, so I knew about movements of the people. But hey, why wasn't the British, if you like, proto-socialists, why weren't we ever taught about them? Mm. And the answer's obvious, because it might give us all ideas. And because what they were saying there in the Putney debates and elsewhere was a manifesto for a kinder, more caring society, but without the kind of savagery of Bolshevism or the French Revolution. Mm. Compared to them, and although, of course, it's couched in Renaissance terms with a lot of biblical references and so on, reading what they had to say is astonishing. And the other thing, of course, which once again I wasn't taught, is when Cromwell had some of them shot, and was rewarded by the banks with a load of gold, the whole of working class London, but a hell of a lot of people turned out for their funeral, wearing green ribbons, which I suppose was the red ribbon of its day. So there's a lot of passion there for those characters. And I've had to kind of keep it in check in Defoe, because after all, he's in a miserable dead end job dealing with the dead, you know. Yeah. And it's a horrible job. And I don't think that's something that's really been addressed before. I mean, killing zombies for a living is not really a cool job. It's a horrible job. It's like working down the sewers or something. And these stiffs are wandering around, you know, taking bites out of people. It's horrible. So it would attract, by definition, it would attract a bunch of freaks. So Defoe is leading this, or has led in the past, the Brethren of the Night, a miserable gang of misfits who can't find any better work, you know?
Well, coming back to your point about the levelers, I was reading a little while ago a blog post by a history teacher who said that they're actually really difficult to bring up, because they appear out of nowhere and then disappear, and there's no mention of their ideas. There's no repeat of their ideas for another century and a half. But certainly, you can't understand that period without knowing about them, because so much of what Cromwell did and what Parliament did was a reaction to, you know, the threat of the levelers, that, you know,
the
army is in mutiny.
Serious threat.
Yeah.
And the other thing as well was that there were, and this was part of the background of the levelers, was that there were all kinds of crazy religious factions at the time. Mm. And, they would certainly be of great interest to kids in history lessons. I would have loved them. There were obvious ones like the Quakers. They originated in this time. Mm. But there were others who tried to reach an exalted, an alternative state. And there wasn't cannabis around at that time. So what they did, they tried to reach an altered state by swearing and smoking a lot. and this wasn't an isolated thing. There was a whole bunch of them, because suddenly, for the first time, the British population was semi-literate through the Bible. Mm. And so they were applying their knowledge and interest of alternative lifestyles, especially after the monarchy had proven to be, to have betrayed the nation. And so they were looking at alternatives. And as I say, this was one of them. And by comparison with some of the crazy factions around, the level has actually made a lot of sense. Mm. But as I say, isn't it interesting how the same parallels arise as with today, where Cromwell actually, you know, got bought off by the banks. They presented him with a lot of gold plate, I believe, after he had crushed the leveller uprisings and I think shot a number of the ringleaders, I think by firing squad, I believe outside the old St. Paul's Cathedral. A colourful event, which again, you know, I think, God, these are one, I mean, these really bring history alive. And I don't know, these are scenes I'd love to see more of. And the tortures that they put people through in the army in those days. I guess you haven't had that as a reenactor. What do they call it?
Riding the horse.
Yeah, riding the horse,
yep.
Which is very painful because it's got a razor edge.
Yeah.
So you just, and they put a couple of weights on either side of your on your feet. So I hope when you're at your reenactors, Mike, they don't do that to you.
No, it has been brought up as a threat, but never followed through, thank goodness.
I'm relieved to hear that. Yeah.
I mean, one of the things I want to talk about was as regards Grub Street. Do you see kind of parallels with the chapbooks of the 17th century with the tabloid journalism of today, the fake news we find ourselves kind of having to wade through in order to get the truth? Do you see a direct line between then and now?
Yeah, there are parallels. I mean, for example, we have in Grub Street, there's a pub, and this is actually authentic. There was a chapbook or a magazine called The London Spy, which is remarkably like Private Eye. And the landlord of the tavern recites bawdy poetry and supposedly raises issues of scandals and so on. But for the most part, they weren't actually that scandalous. But Defoe's paymaster, for example, Dan Jones, which is a shortened version of his full name, which is authentic, I hasten to add, if Christ had not died for thee, thou wouldst be damned, Jones. He's a journalist on the Intelligencer. And the Intelligencer, which I suppose was the Guardian or the Independent of its day, it's running fake news for the most part. So, there are parallels with today. For example, instead of saying that Defoe is responsible for dealing with these various zombie outbreaks and resolving them, the kind of vizards, the superheroes of their day, are taking the credit. So, there are parallels there. And you know what? It's so fascinating. There's a part of me that thinks, oh, God, it's really the kind of stuff one should do in a novel to really get into the complexity of it. Because, there's only so much you can really cover in a six-page episode where, you know, your primary requirement really is to have an exciting and humorous story. But you think, oh, yeah, there's all this extra stuff. And that's always, a challenge with comics. I mean, maybe we have to do more DVD extras on the albums or something. So many readers now, perhaps have always been, very interested in the background to these stories. Oh, and that reminds me of one that several readers have suggested, and Colin has suggested it as well, so I think I probably have to do this one as the next story. And that is, there was a 17th century space program to put a man on the moon. Oh, you knew that?
Yes.
I thought you would. Yeah, and again, I'm sure you know, it was it Cromwell's son, not his son, but a cousin or some relative of Cromwell's who was involved with it. And they did actually work out you know, with tremendous confidence, you know, how they were going to do this. And yeah, the thought that, you know, Britain could have been first on the moon. I have to do that, don't I? I mean, you know, there's no way I can't, you know, how zombies play a role in this, I'm not sure. Shouldn't be too difficult, though.
Brilliant. Well, to be quite frank, I'm very much looking forward to that. It has to be said. I mean, in terms of where the strip is going, you know, each series of foe faces a new challenge, new type of zombie, and you know, a new dark force pulling the strings. Does he have an end? Does he have a point at which he lays down his ridiculously large gun?
Well, I suppose ultimately it will be down to the readers, really. In other words, if the readers continue to like the character, there are so many potential stories with Defoe, because he has moved over more towards detective work. Mm. Because you know, yeah, I could have him just sort of blowing away zombies every week, but you know, I, as you know, I like my characters to progress and to change and to adapt. I mean, you know, they don't want to be like Biffo the Bear, you know, just doing the same thing, you know, for umpteen decades or whatever. So currently he has detective skills, and of course he has an assistant, Mungo Gallowgrass. And so it's sort of scene of crime stuff. So he's, you know, they're using early forensic skills plus intuition. Mm. And I think that's quite nice to play that out for a while. And I think as long as there are fascinating subjects like the British plan to put a man on the moon in the 17th century, as long as those kind of stories are around, I don't think... you know, I don't think it should come to an end. I think if those kind of stories with those fantasy elements, you know, if there weren't enough of them, but I mean, currently, I mean, there's just so many possibilities. I mean, there's some areas, for instance, of 17th century Britain I deliberately won't look at, because I think, oh, God, you know, if I get into this, I could spend, I don't know, 2 or 3 weeks researching it. And then it's a story backed up, because that's the thing with comic stories, as you know, they can often take a year or so to appear. Mm. So I'm thinking, oh, that could be a story in 2 years' time or even 3 years' time. And so, yeah, I almost have to sort of wear blinkers a lot of the time so I don't get caught up in those other possibilities.
Thanks again to Pat Mills for some really fascinating insight into Defoe. For reasons already discussed, I'm very much looking forward to sinking my teeth into it. There isn't a day goes by when there isn't a discussion online about the Dread movie from 2012. Continues to be a massive cult hit. And one of the things we've enjoyed doing is expanding the world from the movie through the comic book tie-in in the Judge Dredd magazine. The Dredd title has been written by Arthur Wyatt, but the Anderson series, The Deep End, was written by Alec Worley. This follows Anderson as she hits the streets on her own and really establishes herself as a judge in her own right. Alec also has been writing novellas about comic book Anderson's first year on the street. So he'd really kind of digging down into the lore around one of our most popular characters. So I had a chat with him about The Deep End, which is coming out in a US format comic book at the end of May. Tell us a little bit about this story. I mean, it's already appeared in the magazine, but it's coming out in a one-shot American format comic in May.
Yep.
Tell us a little bit about the plot of The Deep End.
Okay, so it takes place fairly recently after the events of the movie. So she's become a pass. She's now on the street. She spent a little bit of time on the street. And but there's still a lingering kind of sense of, I guess you call it imposter syndrome, that I'm sure all of us have, where She's now achieved a certain status, but there's kind of part of her that's like, you know, did I just get lucky? She's kind of feeling anxiety about whether she's actually up to the job, and she gets called to a strange case in one city block, and they're not city blocks, are they really? But oh, they are. Sorry, babbling on, it all kind of goes from there. So it's on one level, it's really just about her overcoming this kind of lingering fear and anxiety that she had from the Peachtree's case. I don't really want to say too much about the story, other than it's a kind of is it supernatural? Isn't it? Kind of deal.
Well, that was going to be one of my questions, is about the SF elements of the movie Dread universe, because it really downplayed those. It was very dystopian. It didn't go crazy. I mean, Cass's psychic abilities was kind of the most out there sci-fi idea of the movie. When you're doing the comic book and you can do whatever you want, because that very much was a product of the budget and the look they were going for. But when you're doing a comic book, you can do whatever you want. How tempting is it to start to introduce more sci-fi elements?
Well, that was that's a good question, because one of the first things I had to do just in the research stage was, obviously there's a big difference between the comic book version of the Dreadverse and the movie version. So it was important to kind of distinguish exactly how that difference manifested itself. So I read a ton of interviews with not only the actors, but just in terms of the world in the director of photography and the production designer, just to kind of get a sense of what was the rationale behind all of this. And it was it's completely kind of straight. It's very bleak. And I had to kind of carefully go through some of the previous Dreads with Arthur Wire and just kind of see what had he established. Because in the last story, Dust, there was a guy who could manipulate storms and so dust storms and everything. So I had to kind of take that into account. But from what I could tell, there wasn't a side division that everybody knew about in the city. And it was just about trying to work out. So because this is the real world to a degree, if something happened, if demons appeared or whatever, people would react to them as we would if we saw them in reality. So it was just all about kind of taking it back to the baseline of reality and making sure that everybody responded to it that way, rather than a kind of, you know, oh, that's some freaky thing. We see those all the time, as people do in the comic version.
Because Anderson is obviously played by Olivia Thirlby in the movie, mm-hmm. How important was it for you to nail not just the way that Alec Garland wrote the script for the movie, but also the way that Olivia Thirlby delivers it?
Oh, massively important. I mean, last night I went through a ton of interviews with Olivia Thirlby just to get an idea of how she approached the role. And again, having written the comic book version of Anderson in prose, and then coming into comics and writing the movie version of Anderson, I kind of had a very distinct idea of how the two Andersons differed. And comic book Anderson is very much, she kind of plays like a rock star. She's very cocksure. She's very cavalier. She's fearless. She's also quite petulant. She's also quite arrogant in a way. Whereas movie Cass is much more of a nerd. She's much more of a swot. And you can tell that in the dialogue and in her approach. Is this kind of, she's very focused, but she's also very anxious. And that, if you take an example in Monsters University, if you ever seen that Pixar movie, comic book Anderson is Sully, and movie Cass is Mike. It's the one that's actually had to like work for this, rather than just strutting around on her own talent kind of thing. So it was what I wanted to do was just start with the character and say, right, well, what will be going through her mind after she's been at Peachtree's? And that's literally where I started, and was just like, well, she'd be feeling like this. Well, then how is the best way to make that anxiety and fear manifest? And the other thing was kind of not a pet hate, because it doesn't really happen too much, but I really wanted to get her out of the rookie mode. I feel that Anderson is one of the most complex and one of the richest characters in 2000 AD, and she kind of deserves more than just to be thought of as psychic status. She's way better than that. And so I wanted to kind of, if we're going to do any more of these, was just to kind of, okay, let's just bury the rookie stuff right from the beginning and make the first story about her getting over that. She's no longer the sidekick. She's now her own person. And then we can kind of go off and do some other stuff with her. So yeah, that was how I kind of defined the differences between the two.
I mean, when we started this conversation, I certainly didn't think we were going to get a comparison to a Pixar movie during the course of it. But it's nice to see where you're pitching, the level you're pitching at.
Yeah, no, I'm a big Pixar Disney fan. I mean, I think since my daughter just watches everything, and you kind of the amount of stuff I've learned about storytelling from watching New Wave Disney and Pixar movies and DreamWorks movies is astonishing, just in terms of visual storytelling and how they do this stuff. Even like Pixar, even their B material, like The Good Dinosaur, this is just amazing. And you can apply so much of that to comics and just kind of tell stories without any dialogue, basically. But yeah, it's all good.
One challenge you've already mentioned there is the fact you've got a novel coming out soon from Rebellion Publishing, which collects your Cadet Anderson stuff. It's a prose novel. Is it coming out next month?
It's June 15th, I think. Yes, yeah, June 15th, I think.
June. Okay.
Yeah, it's actually it's a collection of three e-novellas that I did. That was all about her first year on the streets. The first one was Heartbreaker, second one's The Abyss, and the third one, which hasn't actually come out yet, I think it's been released separately as an ebook, is called The Dream of the Nevertime. And that again was kind of coming from a similar place, and then it was going back to the kind of before we actually see her in the comics in the Bolland strip. And yeah, so and it was just about, okay, so you've got this character. Here's what she's like. Let's put her in situations and throw her into situations where you're really testing her and saying, well, you know, well, what if her psychic ability became her biggest downfall? What if she was trapped in a psychic insane asylum where all these vibes are getting to her and she starts unraveling herself? And well, what if she caught a psychic virus? And all, you know, just kind of seeing ways into the character that you can kind of really open it up and get into her, get into a character in ways that, you know, maybe the comic strip doesn't have time to do on the page.
When you've got such an iconic character such as Anderson, is there a certain amount of feeling of weight on your shoulders, even though you're not, you know, you're not writing, for want of a better phrase, the main Anderson strip, because it's Alan Grant and Emma Beebe who've done that, but where you're exploring her in different guises, different mediums, because, you know, prose, but also reflecting on the movie.
Yeah.
Was there a feeling of intimidation? Was there a feeling of weight being placed on your shoulders, or was it, this is an amazing sandpit that I get to go and play in?
Probably a bit of both. I mean, it's the same thing with when you're writing Dread. I mean, you can sit there and just get paralyzed, or you can just kind of switch on and just be a professional and just kind of say, you know what, I don't care, and just jump in and just get on with it. I think once you get to grips with them as a character, and you're comfortable with who they are, and you're confident that you can tell an interesting story based on, digging into all their kind of weaknesses and insecurities and everything, and you feel that that's spinning out into a good story, then all that kind of worry just kind of goes away. And I say it's exactly the same with Dread. You know, if you get too overawed with that sort of stuff, you just get paralyzed and maybe kind of fall back more on kind of reverential, you know, sort of respect for the past or quite what, rather than just going, do you know what, just hoof it up in the air and see what happens and just have fun with it. Would probably be my way of thinking about that.
How did you come to be working on the movie version of Anderson for the magazine originally?
I just pitched it to Matt. I'd enjoyed Arthur's books, and I think it was Henry Flint did the first one. Then it was Paul David. So yeah, Paul Davidson has worked with me on the one. No, I literally I just pitched it to Matt. I said, oh, it'd be great if we could do a an Anderson spin-off, and he was like, yep, good, and then pitched the story and just kind of cracked on from there. Just waiting to hear back about any future ones, and yeah, we'll see where it goes. It's kind of interesting, really, in the way that it was Buffy after season 7 finished, the series carried on officially in the form of a comic book, which I kind of feel is like an ideal platform to just open up everything else and just sort of see, well, what else is going on in this world and explore it that way.
And in terms of you know, if there were more stories, where would you want to go? What are the I mean, 'cause everyone always mentions Judge Death, but that seems to be a shadow that always seems to fall over the future of any Dredd and Anderson stuff.
Yeah.
Are there comic book stories you'd like to retell in the movie universe, or are there things that you'd like to bring in to really play with?
I can't really say without spoiling the ending of the last story in the floppy that's coming out. But yeah, I mean, it's what would be great is to go back and just look at some classic Anderson stories, and just how would this play in the movieverse? If you were just kind of rebooting this via the movie, how would it play out? But at the same time, I mean, things like Judge Death, I mean, what works on the page might not work on a movie thing. I don't know. I think that's a big one. I think you'd have to kind of play that differently, and maybe that for me would have to be a big event rather than just a throwaway idea. But the difficulty with Anderson is that she's difficult to write simply because she's a psychic, and it's the same thing that I found in doing the prose version of her as well, is that she's so all you're trying to build a scene, on dramatic tension, and one of the ways in which you create that is by withholding information. Well, Anderson is a character that knows what everyone's thinking the minute she steps in a room, so she has the potential to just ruin every scene that she walks into. I think when I got the initial commission for the first Anderson novella, it was like that it had to be a whodunit. And I kind of had to explain back, well, you can't really have a whodunit with a detective who is psychic, because if this was if Clarice Starling was psychic, the story would be over like the minute you drag the first body out the river. Yeah, he done it, I'm going for a coffee, and that's the story's finished. So she kind of comes, she's got so many layers of conflict to her, which is terrific as a character. It's exactly what you want. But at the same time, the psychic stuff and trying to establish what the rules of all those psychic, you know, widgets and laws, the kind of the game that you're playing, you have to kind of set the rules up in order for it to still work as drama, if you sort of mean. You can't just go, woohoo, we'll do anything.
Yeah.
Then it's like, yeah, but if you could do that, why can't you do this? And just making sure that you've thought it all through, I guess. So yeah, she kind of comes with her own, she's very good at creating stories, I think, but very difficult at for the writer to resolve them, I think.
These things have been so elastic over the years as well. So it's always a thing that whenever Dredd does a police procedural or a whodunit, you think, well, why don't they just go and get Cydivision to come along? Yeah, well, because that would be the end of the story within two pages. So
exactly. I mean, the thing is as well, storytelling itself in comics has changed dramatically over the last, like, I'd probably even say last 10 years. You can't really write comics the way you used to write comics back in the 90s. I remember reading it was an X-Men crossover, The Inferno. You ever read that one, X-Men?
Oh yeah, a long time ago.
It was like a cross between Who Framed Roger Rabbit and Labyrinth, but with the X-Men. And it didn't make any sense at all. It was just absolutely just mental.
Yeah.
And you think, you couldn't write like this anymore. As fun as it is, you can't really write like this anymore, because there's been this kind of storytelling culture's moved more to kind of dramatic stringency. We have to kind of work out, well, why are they doing that? What's motivating them to do that? You can't just fling anything on the page and hope it will work. And you find that in kids' media as well. Maybe going back to like the thing, because writing for kids as well, as I do, I write Star Wars and Turtles and stuff. It's like, after things like Disney and Pixar, you can't just throw any old crap at kids anymore. It has to work dramatically. You have to have motivations for the characters. I've even had conversations with Nickelodeon saying, well, what is Michelangelo's motive for cracking this joke? You have to kind of think it all through, you know? Sorry, rambling on there.
No, not at all, not at all. In terms of what's coming up for you from 2000 AD, you know, what have you got in store for the readers of The Galaxy's Greatest?
Oh, geez, I'm still waiting to hit back on a pitch, to be honest.
And then, right.
We'll go from there. So, in terms of stuff that's out, obviously there's the Anderson collection coming out, the prose book's coming out in June. There's the floppy that's coming out, and it's also coming out again as a trade with Arthur White and Ben Wilshire's Dust. Have I got that right?
Yeah.
I've got a couple of stories in one of the recent Dread collections, including the one I did with Eric Powell, the Free Comic Book Day one. And we'll see where it goes from there, I guess. Yeah.
And we're going to have the pleasure of your company at Forbidden Planet on the 27th of May, was it?
Yep, that's it. Woohoo!
Well, thank you very much indeed to Alec. That was absolutely fascinating to see how he juggles all those different versions of Anderson. Make sure you grab a copy of The Deep End when it comes out in May, and also the collected edition where it's bound up with Dust, and that's coming out in the summer. And if you're in London on the 27th of May, pop along to Forbidden Planet to meet Alec and also Slain artist Simon Davis. Well, we'll be back next week with another of the panels from the 40th anniversary event in Hammersmith. Hope you've enjoyed this latest edition of the 2080 Thrillcast Earthlets. Please do let us know what you think, whether it's a comment on Facebook or Twitter, or an email to Thrillcast, that's all one word, thrillcast@2080online.com. We'd love to hear your suggestions about people you'd like us to feature in future episodes. We will be back in 2 weeks with more from the galaxy's greatest comic. Until that time, Earthlets, Splendid Birthday.
Alert! 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 Thrill power levels dangerously high. Alert! Alert! Read 2000 AD every week. Ask your comic book store or newsagent now. Subscribe to the galaxy's greatest comic at 2000adonline.com. Subscribe digitally on our apps for Apple, Android, and Windows 10. And download DRM free copies from 2080online.com. Alert! Alert! Stand by for urgent updates. Search for 2080 on Twitter and Facebook. Watch the latest videos at youtube.com/2080online. And follow on Instagram at Insta2080. Program complete. Shutting down.